Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We saw young victims, and we saw very old victims, and all just had the same type of wounds. They had puncture wounds on their faces, they had amputated limbs, they had open abdomens, intestines out, bowels out.
Widespread fear has gripped Lebanon after a second wave of explosions of booby-trapped electronic devices, including pagers and walkie-talkies. At least 37 people have been killed since Tuesday, over 3,500 injured in explosions involving devices that may have secretly been made by Israeli intelligence. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then we speak to Maya Berry, the executive director of the Arab American Institute. She came under hostile questioning by Republican senators in a hearing on hate crimes.
I think it's exceptionally disappointing that you're looking at an Arab American witness before you and saying you support Hamas.
You know what's disappointing to me?
I do not support Hamas.
You can't bring yourself
to say support Hamas.
You don't support UNRWA. You don't support Hamas. You don't.
I was very clear in my support for UNRWA.
And you don't support Iran. You should hide your head in a bag.
We'll also talk to Illinois Democratic Congressmember Delia Ramirez, sponsor of a bill to honor hate crime victim Wadi Al-Fayoumi, a six-year-old Palestinian boy stabbed to death by his landlord in a Chicago suburb last October. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Lebanon, at least 25 people were killed, more than 600 others wounded on Wednesday, when more handheld electronic devices exploded without warning. Most of the explosions were of walkie-talkies, but there are also reports of mobile phones, laptops, even solar panels suddenly exploding. The blast sowed further panic across Beirut and southern Lebanon one day after some 4,000 pagers exploded simultaneously, killing 12 people and leaving thousands more with gruesome injuries. Wednesday's explosions triggered fires that engulfed homes, stores, cars and motorcycles. Some of the blasts occurred during the funeral of 9-year-old Fatima Abdullah, who was killed in Tuesday's pager attack. Lebanon has banned pagers and walkie-talkies on all flights, while Lebanese citizens say they now live in fear everyday household electronics could suddenly explode. It's widely believed Israel is behind the attacks. This is Lebanese politician Ahmad Hariri.
The Lebanese people must be aware of what the Israeli enemy aims to achieve. They want to sow discord among us or strike Lebanon at a time when international attention is focused on the upcoming American elections. This suggests that the Israeli army might be preparing to execute a malicious plan to strike Lebanon like they struck Gaza.
The New York Times reports the electronic pagers had been manufactured by a company in Hungary, BAC Consulting, that was actually a front company run by Israeli intelligence officers. Many of the pagers were obtained earlier this year after Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah warned against using cell phones to avoid Israeli surveillance. On Wednesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned nations against weaponizing civilian objects.
The logic of making all these devices explode is to do it as a preemptive strike before a major military operation. So, as important as the event in itself is the indication that this event confirms that there is a serious risk of a dramatic escalation in Lebanon, and everything must be done to avoid that escalation.
This all comes as Israel's declared it's launching a new phase of war, redirecting forces from Gaza to Israel's northern border with Lebanon. But Israel's carnage in Gaza continues, with deadly attacks reported today in Rafah and Jabalia, while many children were injured in Israeli quadcopter attack on Nusayrat. Rescue workers are rushing to uncover possible survivors buried under rubble in the Barij camp. And Khan Yunis, a father, mourned the loss of nearly his entire family to an Israeli strike, including his three children. His youngest was just a year and a half.
Come and see, what did he do? 1 year and 9 months old, what did he do? Did he fire a rocket? He was sitting safe amongst us. Look, people, look, O world, 1 year and 9 months old. Look at how my son is.
The Palestinian Health Ministry said Wednesday Dr. Ziad Mohammed Al-Dalou, who was abducted by Israeli forces during its March raid on Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital, has died in an Israeli jail. He's the third doctor to die in Israeli custody since October 7th, and one of at least 60 Palestinians who've since perished in Israeli prisons, which are rife with abuse and torture. The United Nations General Assembly adopted a resolution Wednesday demanding Israel end its illegal occupation of Palestinian territories within a year. 124 countries voted in favor of the non-binding resolution. Israel and the United States were among the 12 member states to vote no. It was the first resolution formally introduced by the State of Palestine since it took a permanent seat in the General Assembly last week. In Washington, D.C., independent Senator Bernie Sanders is preparing a joint resolution of disapproval against a planned $20 billion in U.S. arms sales to Israel. He spoke from the Senate floor Wednesday.
Netanyahu's policies have trampled on international law, made life unlivable in Gaza, and created one of the worst humanitarian disasters in modern history. The simple fact is that we must end our complicity in Israel's illegal and indiscriminate military campaign, which has caused mass civilian death and suffering.
Meanwhile, Reuters is reporting that Germany appears to have put a hold on new exports of weapons to Israel amidst ongoing legal challenges. In campaign news here in the United States, the Teamsters Union says it is not endorsing a presidential candidate for the first time since 1996. The union, which endorsed Biden in 2020, says neither candidate had enough support from their 1.3 million strong membership. Teamsters President Sean O'Brien in July addressed the Republican National Convention in a first for the union. But Kamala Harris on Wednesday did gain support of more than 100 former Republican officials, including ex-Congress members, defense secretaries, CIA directors, and others, who declared in an open letter that Trump is, quote, unfit to serve again as president. Over a dozen House Republicans joined Democrats on Wednesday in rejecting Republican Speaker Mike Johnson's six-month government spending bill. The stopgap bill would have tied $1.6 trillion in government funding to a measure requiring states to ask residents for proof of citizenship when registering to vote. Hours before Wednesday's House vote, Donald Trump called on Republicans to reject any spending package that does not include the voter suppression measure. If no bill is passed before the end of the month, the federal government will shut down October 1st, when early voting will be underway for November's election. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke Wednesday at a Congressional Hispanic Caucus event, warning of mass deportations and massive detention camps if Trump is reelected.
Donald Trump and his extremist allies will keep trying to pull us backward. We all remember what they did to tear families apart. And now they have pledged to carry out the largest deportation, a mass deportation, in American history. Imagine what that would look like and what that would be. How's that going to happen? Massive raids? Massive detention camps?
Immigrant rights advocates have blasted Harris for adopting the same hardline stance on immigration as her Republican rivals and her focus on criminalizing immigrants and militarizing the border. The Federal Reserve has lowered its benchmark interest rate by half a percentage point, the Fed's first rate cut since March 2020. Progressive economists and labor leaders praised the Fed's move, but said it came far too late for many households. The AFL-CIO said in a statement, quote, interest rates are still too high. There's still more to be done for families struggling to pay their bills, unquote. Last week, the U.S. Census Bureau reported the child poverty rate has more than doubled since Congress allowed expanded pandemic benefits to expire. Including the child tax credit, leaving millions of families with less money for essentials like rent and food. In Tunisia, authorities led by Kais Saied have accelerated a crackdown on opposition candidates and peaceful protests ahead of presidential elections scheduled for October 6. Amnesty International reports at least 97 members of an opposition party were arrested in recent days as authorities continue to restrict the work of journalists, human rights defenders and NGOs while further undermining the independence of Tunisia's judiciary. The latest raids began last Friday when thousands of protesters rallied in Tunis to demand the release of political prisoners and an end to Kais Saied's authoritarian rule. In Mali, the government has regained control over the capital city, Bamako, after repelling several attacks by al-Qaeda-affiliated insurgents. On Tuesday, gunmen attacked a military police center and battled Russian mercenaries with the Wagner Group at an airbase near Bamako's airport. Malian officials have not confirmed a death toll. It's the first attack by armed groups on Bamako since 2016, and the first since Mali's military rulers expelled troops from Mali's former colonial ruler, France. Bamako residents fear more attacks could be imminent.
There's no sense of security the way the camp was attacked. If we didn't have seasoned soldiers, the terrorists would have taken it. And then what about us civilians?
And here in New York, protesters are demanding an end to police presence in the city's subway system as anger mounts over Sunday's shooting of four people by a New York police officer who was pursuing a suspected fare evader. One of two bystanders shot remains hospitalized in critical condition. On Tuesday, police arrested 18 people as they protested at the Sutter Avenue L station in Brooklyn where the shooting took place. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Lebanon, where there's widespread fear after a second wave of explosions involving electronic devices went off across the country. Israeli agents are reportedly responsible for rigging the devices. On Wednesday, thousands of walkie-talkies and other devices blew up, killing more than 25 people and injuring more than 600. Some of the blasts occurred at funerals for victims of Tuesday's explosions, which targeted electronic pagers, when 12 people were killed and nearly 3,000 injured, including many members of Hezbollah. This was the scene at one funeral on Wednesday.
Lebanon's foreign minister, Abdullah Bouhabib, condemned what he called a blatant assault on Lebanon's sovereignty and security, unquote. Hospitals in Lebanon have been overwhelmed with severe injuries as patients have come in after losing eyes and limbs.
We saw young victims, and we saw very old victims, and all just had the same type of wounds. They had puncture wounds on their faces. They had amputated limbs. They had open abdomens, intestines out, bowels out. Unfortunately, there were wounds that we couldn't explain. There were ruptured eyeballs. There were fractured mandibles, fractured bones, bones out. So basically, it was. It was the first time I ever see wounds like that. I couldn't even classify some wounds or categorize some wounds.
The New York Times reports the electronic pagers have been manufactured by a front company run by Israeli intelligence officers. Many of the pagers were obtained earlier this year after Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah warned against the use of cell phones to avoid Israeli surveillance. On Wednesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the weaponization of civilian objects.
I think it's very important that there is an effective control of civilian objects, not to weaponize civilian objects. That should be a rule that everywhere in the world governments should be able to implement. The link of what's happening in Lebanon with what's happening in Gaza is obvious since the beginning. I mean, the Hezbollah has been very clear in saying that it has launched its operations because of what's happening in Gaza, and that it will stop when there will be a ceasefire in Gaza.
On Wednesday, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Israel's focus is turning more to its northern border with Lebanon. He said, quote, "We're at the start of a new phase in the war," unquote. Meanwhile, Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah is scheduled to give a televised speech today. We go now to Beirut, where we're joined by Lada Bitar, editor-in-chief of The Public Source, a Beirut-based independent media organization. Thanks so much for being with us. These last 2 days, Lada, have been unprecedented. You have the shock of Tuesday when all of these pagers exploded, killing 12 people, injuring close to 3,000. And then yesterday, more explosions and walkie-talkies and not clear what other electronic devices. The total, 37 dead, something like 3,500 people injured. Can you describe the situation on the ground right now?
Good morning. So, as you can imagine, the events of the past 2 days have caused a lot of panic, a lot of fear, and to a large extent, paranoia, which was aided by disinformation campaign to a large extent. Over the past couple of days, or at least yesterday, for the most part, people were receiving messages over different WhatsApp groups, on social media platforms, that any and every electronic device can be detonated by the Israelis. So people were scared of using their cell phones. People were hearing that even kitchen appliances were exploding, solar panels, laptops, and so on. Thankfully, for the most part, this turned out to be a disinformation campaign, and it did not really was not really materializing on the ground as was being reported across different channels. That's maybe the only solace from the events of the past couple of days, where we saw civilian areas and civilians being targeted. This has been widely reported in the Western press as a sophisticated campaign that targeted alleged Hezbollah operatives. But the reality is that for the most part, these explosions were occurring in civilian areas, in vegetable markets, in the supermarket, and the funeral, as you mentioned. And that's on one hand, but also on the other, not everybody who's carrying these pagers and these walkie-talkies is a Hezbollah fighter, nor were any of them on the combat field. Or on the front lines in the southern part of the country. It's very important to note that Hezbollah is not just a resistance group or a militant group. Hezbollah is also a political party here in Lebanon that is represented in parliament. And Hezbollah also runs and operates several large civil institutions. So we saw medical personnel and healthcare workers being killed and injured and maimed by these explosions. We saw children. We saw even the Iranian diplomat. So this was an indiscriminate attack that made the Lebanese population feel that anyone can be targeted at any point, anywhere in the country.
Well, Lada Bitar, if you could respond, give us a sense of what you expect Hassan Nasrallah to say today when he speaks at 5 p.m. Beirut time. You've suggested that this might be the very early stage of a much larger and much bigger war that has the potential to implicate the entire country. What are you expecting in terms of a response from Hezbollah?
It's very difficult to anticipate what the Secretary General will be saying today. But one thing is clear, at least to my mind and to many who are following very closely what's been happening in Lebanon. It seems that the Israeli government has already taken an action, a decision to escalate, to wage a full-scale war on all of Lebanon. And it seems to me that it doesn't really matter what Hezbollah decides to do at this point and what form of retaliation the party engages in, that the genocidal Israeli government has made up its mind to launch a full-scale war on all of the population. And I think the 2006 war between Israel and Lebanon can give us some significant clues as to what could potentially happen. So in 2006, which was a war that lasted about 33 or 34 days, Israel started off by cutting communication lines. That was the first thing that it did before launching a wider scale war on the rest of the country. And it seems like this is what it's doing yet again, cutting the communication lines, and not just of Hezbollah members, but for military personnel, for paramedics, for aid workers, doctors, and so on, causing a lot of disorientation, a lot of chaos, a lot of panic. And then this would be acting as a prelude to something that could potentially be much bigger and much scarier.
Lara Bitar, I'd like to ask you about what the response has been from different political parties in Lebanon to these widespread attacks. Let's just go to Lebanese parliamentarian Mark Dow, who spoke to the BBC earlier today. This is what he had to say.
The reality is Lebanon has been suffering for the past 11 months from the war in Gaza, economically, financially, but also because we had some unilateral actions by Hezbollah as well to start bombing from South Lebanon. We're talking to Hezbollah and telling them, you need to take all your decisions within the institutions of the state. Acting as a rogue unilateral actor on the military front is causing all of Lebanon damages because of Israeli aggressions, their genocidal war, and their lack of respect for the rules of war or even for crimes against humanity.
So, Lara, if you could respond to what Mark Dow said and whether this is a widespread belief, the fact that Hezbollah is operating unilaterally and that it should not be. It should be working within the imperatives and desires of the Lebanese state.
So Lebanon is split between two camps. On one hand, you have Hezbollah supporters who believe that we have a moral, ethical, political duty to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people in Gaza and also in the West Bank. Hezbollah scholar Amal Saad referred to this as anticipatory self-defense and as military solidarity. We can roughly estimate that about half of the country or so supports this operation and this campaign that was initiated by Hezbollah on October 8th. And on the other hand, on the second camp is fiercely in opposition, not only to this operation, but to Hezbollah in general. And they are using the war of the past 11 months as a means to weaken Hezbollah, to attempt to strip the resistance group from its weapons, to demoralize its supporters. The second camp has been consistently lobbying the international community to exert additional pressure on the militant group. So right now, the country is not really unified. But in the aftermath of the two terrorist attacks that took place on Tuesday and then on Wednesday, we saw for the very first time wide condemnation across the board in Lebanon, but also for the first time to some extent in the international community.
You tweeted on Tuesday, the day of the pager explosions, we should learn from the mistakes that were committed in 2000 and not repeat them when the next big day of liberation comes, and it will sooner or later. What did you mean?
Many of us believe that the liberation of Palestine is inevitable and that it's only a matter of time. In that tweet in particular, I was referring to certain individuals, certain groups, and to some extent some political parties who are constantly agitating against Hezbollah, who are who have in the past collaborated with Israel, and who would much rather see the country be completely destroyed rather than maintain Hezbollah in power or have Hezbollah maintain its weapons. In that tweet, I was referring to what happened in the aftermath of liberation in May 2000, when the Southerners who had endured the torture, the abuse, the humiliation by the Israeli occupation forces and their Lebanese allies, those residents were asked to simply turn the page, to forget about what had happened and to coexist with those who had tortured them. And I was just referring to this mistake in particular that I believe has allowed these Zionists to some extent to continue to operate in the country. We saw something happen during the 2006 war, but this was on the level of government officials, and we know this from WikiLeaks cables. Several prominent government officials were agitating for war against Hezbollah. They were pushing the international community and supporting Israel to continue its bombardment of all of Lebanon in order for them to get rid of Hezbollah. And that, in my opinion, is a betrayal of the citizens of the country and the sovereignty of the country.
Well, Lara Bitar, I would like you to talk about what your concerns are about how this war could escalate along the border. I'd just like to go to Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, who spoke Wednesday at an Air Force base near Haifa.
I believe that we are at the start of a new phase in the war, and we must adapt. First of all, the center of gravity is moving north. The meaning is that we are moving resources and forces and energy in the northern direction. The action is being done by all the bodies, and the goal is a clear one, and it's simple: to return the residents of the communities in the north to their homes safely.
So, Lara Bitar, what do you think that means, they're moving forces to the northern border?
It's difficult to predict, but again, looking at the 2006 war, we can expect the bombing of bridges, of roads, power plants, irrigation and drinking water systems, and other vital infrastructure. In 2006, airport runway was also bombarded, and Israel imposed a sea, air, and land blockade on Lebanon. But I just want to address the point that this war that Israel will be waging against Lebanon is an attempt to return its settlers to the northern part of occupied Palestine. And I imagine that this is how most media organizations will be reporting on this war. But I think it's important for us to go back a little bit in history and recall that Zionist organizations as early as 1919 were pushing for the demarcation of the border after the Litani River, which means 30 kilometers or 19 or 20 miles deep inside Lebanon. So this is not really very much about returning the settlers to their homes, but this is about this long-standing desire and intent of the Zionist project to seize the Litani River.
And Lara Bitar, finally,
or I should say parts of the Litani River. Yes.
Will this make Hezbollah more popular in Lebanon and compare its power to the Lebanese government?
There is no Lebanese government really to speak of. Lebanon is still reeling from an economic crisis that started in 2019. The state is almost bankrupt. Most state institutions are barely functional. There's absolutely no comparison between the power of the Lebanese government in comparison to Hezbollah.
Lara Bitar, we want to thank you very much.
And as far as Hezbollah's
Go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to respond to the question of Hezbollah's popularity and support. We do know that Hezbollah supporters are only increasing their actions, their mobilizations, their support of the party, and it doesn't really seem to matter what the political group does or the militant group does. Their supporters are fiercely behind them, and what we've been hearing over the past couple of days, but also over the past 11 months, is that they continue to be even more determined to wage this war against Israel. And supporters of the party and loyalists to the party are willing to give up their children, their homes, their livelihoods,